Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to start the show today by talking about movement disorders with our guest, Dr. Laura Bouillon-Dent. She's a neurologist and the director of the Movement Disorders and Parkinson's Program at UW Health. And as we talk with Dr. Bouillon-Dent, I hope you'll join in. Do you or someone you care about have a movement disorder? Let us know about the questions you have about treatments, perhaps. We'll take your questions and comments at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Laura Bouillon-Dent, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again. This is always a fun thing
it's
to
fun
do.
Fun to have you back. How would you define movement disorders?
Yeah, movement disorders are neurologic problems. Difficulties with the brain and the nerves and spine that will result in various types of abnormal movements that can be impairing. One of the major things that we see are people with Parkinson's disease.
That's the most common of those?
That's the most common, right. And this happens to be, Parkinson's Awareness Month.
Yep.
And on April 11th, it's actually World Parkinson's Day, as that's Dr. James Parkinson's birthday, the person who this disease is named after.
And the symptoms, I mean, movements.
Right. Yeah, there's really four classic symptoms. There's a certain type of tremor that people may develop that can affect usually their upper extremities or their arms or their legs. Also, they'll develop a certain type of slowness of movement. To the individual experiencing this, it might feel like a certain type of weakness. And then their movements can get very, very slow. Eventually, people may develop some walking difficulties. They'll tend to fall down a fair amount. And those are the main classic symptoms.
Voice changes?
There can be voice changes as well. A very soft voice might develop. Sometimes some swallowing difficulties as well.
So what do we know about what causes movement disorders, Parkinson's?
Right. Yeah, that's the million or billion dollar question. The current thinking is that there is likely a genetic predisposition. There's been several genes that have been associated with development of Parkinson's disease. And then some other things seem to need to happen to trigger it. So just having the gene in the majority of people does not seem to me cause or guarantee that you're going to be symptomatic. However, we think that something else has to happen to you, either a toxin exposure, maybe even a virus or some other factor that we don't know. And that triggering thing may be different for different individuals.
Yeah. Is it more prevalent in one sex versus the other?
Somewhat more prevalent in men.
Kevin called, couldn't stay with us. He's got a REM behavior sleep disorder, and he's seen studies that say there's a 70 to 80% chance of developing movement disorders like Parkinson's, and wonders if you've heard about that.
Yes, definitely. There's a lot of research going on trying to find an earlier marker of Parkinson's. Currently, we diagnose it by history and clinical exam. We can see certain things on a neurologic exam. However, there have been numerous neuroprotective trials, meaning substances given to try to slow progression of the disease. And those, there's been a couple hundred at least done over the years, and they've all failed. And there's many reasons for that, but one reason could be that we're diagnosing it too late in the course. So we're trying to find earlier markers, and one of which there's been a lot of attention to the REM behavior disorders being a marker. for that. So there are clinical trials going on that are following people with that to see. And there's a variety of things that fall under a Parkinson's umbrella, in a sense. There's idiopathic or garden variety Parkinson's, and then there's these other conditions that can occur. And so all of those are being closely studied to see if then we could do a clinical trial when the REM behavior disorder is diagnosed. You know, are there substances at that point that we could give to slow down progression?
And I bet that's some of the work that's going on with your program. Maybe tell us about the movement disorders and Parkinson's program at UW.
Right. So it consists of, so it's part of the Department of Neurology, and the movement disorders group currently has six physicians and one physician's assistant. And then also, though, throughout UW, as really part of the program, we work closely with neurosurgery, with Dr. Wendell Lake in the deep brain stimulation program. Also across campus, we have specialized physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech and language pathologists, all that we work with that have a special focused interest in Parkinson's disease. And then really, although they're not always part of our department, but there's scientists on campus, too, doing a lot of very exciting research in the basic science, as well as trying to find treatments for Parkinson's disease as well.
Maya in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Maya. Maya, are you there?
Movement disorders, and specifically tardive dyskinesia, which is a side effect of antipsychotics. And I'm just interested if there's research being done on something that's very commonly given to people that have either psychosis or schizophrenia. It's kind of one of the number one reasons why people go off their medication. And I'm just wondering if there's any crossover or conversations about helping out that demographic of people.
Yes, in our movement disorders program, we do see people with tardive dyskinesia. They're usually referred by psychiatry. The psychiatrist, of course, will usually recognize this. And then if they need help managing it, or confirming a diagnosis or ruling out a different movement disorder, they'll refer those patients to us. Currently, with our clinical trials in neurology movement disorders program, we don't have any clinical trials at this particular time related to tardive dyskinesia, and I'm uncertain if there are any in the UW psychiatry department going on at this time. But we do work closely with them, and you know, there's a lot of even informal consults and that sort of thing because of the different ways that we can try to help manage that with people. So far, there's several theories about why that develops when people are exposed to certain medications, usually antipsychotics, or dopamine blocking agents. And it's very interesting. And in the past five years or so, there have been some medications that have become available that have been very useful to help people manage those symptoms.
Mm. Are there, I'm wondering, what are some of those medications, maybe, perhaps?
Yeah. Valbenazine is one, deutetrabenazine, and these are dopamine. They tend to block certain neurotransmitters, is I guess the best way to put it, and they inhibit production of some of the neurotransmitters and works at the connections between the brain cells that we believe are modified by long-term use and sometimes even short-term exposure to some of the psychiatric medications.
Mm. Maya, does that help out?
That helps out a lot. And I would just say as a test case of one, I have a family member that was diagnosed with psychosis and schizophrenia. And they reported to me that they can feel that coming on. So it's really interesting how it gets put in psychiatry, but they are put on a lot of medications when they're trying to control the psychosis. And the issue, I think, for a lot of folks is trying to decrease it to the least level. And so I just think it's something to look into, because I think sometimes these different body disabilities have some commonalities. Yeah. So I hope that they continue to find some research for it.
Maya, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And speaking of emails, Louise sent us one. Are there definitive tests for movement disorders, or is it a matter of clinical observations and deduction? And can you get movement disorders from mold exposure?
All right. So currently, the best way to diagnose movement disorders is through clinical exam and the clinical expertise of the physician. So that's why people who are movement disorder specialists or neurologists who have had additional training in this area so that we can recognize it. In the Parkinson's realm, there are no definitive tests, but there is development of some testing to support a diagnosis, although those tests at this point are a bit controversial, and different clinicians will use them in a variety of ways. For other, it depends on what the disorder is. For Huntington's disease, there is a gene test for that. The interpretation of that test result is very important. But the majority of things, I would think, that I'm diagnosing, it's really based on the clinical history and my neurologic exam and observation of the abnormal movements.
Mark in Wisconsin Dells will give you a chance. Hi, Mark.
Thank you, Larry. I would just like to ask if Lewy body dementia is a type of Parkinson's disease, or is it a separate disease altogether?
Yeah, that's going to undergo evolution over time. Currently, it's on a spectrum of Parkinson's disease. The pathology of dementia with Lewy bodies or Lewy body disease, if you look at the basic science level of it, it's both diseases are caused or have a marker of an abnormally folded protein called alpha-synuclein in the majority of cases. And the defining factor between the two sometimes gets blurred. It is more like one of the atypical forms of Parkinson's is what I would consider it in my view of practice. However, if you met someone who sees people mainly with dementia, they would view it as maybe a different type of dementia. So we're learning more and more about it and how to distinguish it. But, you know, idiopathic Parkinson's or garden variety Parkinson's starts in certain ways. And then sometimes early in the course of the disease, we'll see the onset of significant cognitive difficulties and some other things. And then from another aspect, people will have significant cognitive difficulties and within the first year or two may develop some other signs of tremor or usually rigidity and slowness of movement, stiffness and slowness that will clue us in. So that's a very wishy-washy answer, but it's one of those things where we're continuing to study it. And the definition, for example, for a strict definition for qualifying for a clinical trial keeps changing.
All right. There you go, Mark. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Laura Bouillon-Dent, our guest today, neurologist and director of the Movement Disorders and Parkinson's Program at UW Health. Questions for Dr. Bouillon Dent. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Dr. Laura Bouillon Dent from the University of Wisconsin Health Program, the Movement Disorders and Parkinson's Program. Let me give you the right title here at UW Health, our guest today. And we have many callers online. Just to let you know, at noon today, we'll be talking about shingles, and our guest will be talking about why getting the vaccine is the best way to prevent an infection. Right now, we go to Rick in Eau Claire. Rick, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to mention that I've had Parkinson's for about 12 years, and looking back, I can see aspects of the Parkinson's that I didn't pay much attention to because I seemed part of getting older. And then about 2 years ago, my dyskinesia had become very difficult to cope with. I had constant head movement. Ended up hitting myself sometimes or others because my left arm would just suddenly go all Nazi on me and not follow any rules. But I had DBS surgery just about 2 years ago. And although it certainly didn't cure my Parkinson's and all aspects of it, it took away the tardive dyskinesia in an amazing way. And that it sounds so serious to go through the surgery, but it wasn't. A well-crafted team out of Rochester implemented, I refer to them as my nails in my head, and it was an amazing turnaround for me.
Rick, thanks for calling. Well, talk about this DBS treatment that he was talking about.
Right. DBS has been a remarkable treatment. So in the course of the history of Parkinson's and treatment, the one medicine called Sinemet or Levodopa was a revolutionary treatment that changed many people's lives. And in my opinion, DBS is now a second revolutionary treatment. And we do a lot of this at UW Health. We have an excellent functional neurosurgeon, Dr. Wendell Lake, and his team. For any surgery like this, it's an elective surgery, and patient selection is key. And so our team is really good and experienced at selecting people who will benefit from it because, as this gentleman said, it doesn't cure the disease, but it can markedly improve people's quality of life. And then on the other hand, it is brain surgery. So it's, you know, although the surgeons are quite good at doing it and everything, it's not without some risk. However, it is really remarkable. It's almost you can think of it as a pacemaker for the brain, so to speak, where wire is implanted in your brain, and then you have a battery under your skin in your chest, which is really a computer, and we can manipulate that to create an electrical field in the brain that can help alleviate certain symptoms. And we do it a lot in Parkinson's. We also do it in essential tremor and some other movement disorders as well.
But it's one that you have to pay for out of your own pocket.
No, it is FDA approved, which means Medicare and then other insurances will pay for it. So it's actually part of, in a way, it's now on the list of very classic things that tertiary care centers will offer that have a good Parkinson's and other movement disorder program.
Excellent. Rick, thanks again. Shelley in Two Rivers, thank you for calling.
Hi. What's
on your mind?
Thank you so much for having me on. My husband was diagnosed with Parkinson's in, I think, about 2011, but it took them 6 years to diagnose him and a lot of money out of our pocket. And I am just wondering why, when doctors are suspecting Parkinson's, they can't just give that patient Parkadova Levodopa and see if it helps.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm sorry that it took so long for you and your husband to get an answer. And it's really difficult to know. People, sometimes it's very obvious. They'll have very classic symptoms. Sometimes they won't. I can't speak to what these other doctors did. Often we do use carbidopa levodopa as maybe a test in certain situations. So, yeah. I'm glad that you finally got a diagnosis, and I hope you're connected into some good neurologists taking care of you.
And if that was, if I'm not mistaken, 10, 15 years ago, things have probably changed a bit.
You're right. We've gotten better at recognizing it. We do often recognize it a little earlier in the course of disease. Sometimes, though, it isn't quite as straightforward as you would think.
Yeah. At what age, I mean, basically, this seems to occur more often in elderly or older people. I mean, at what age could this strike?
The spectrum is actually quite broad, but the average age of onset is in the middle 60s, so around 65. Mm. However, I've diagnosed people in their late 20s, early 30s. Other people, they might not start to show definite signs of it until they're in their late 80s. As well. So it's a big spectrum, but usually about 65 or so.
Katie in Madison, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I recently got diagnosed by my primary physician with intention tremor, mm-hmm. and he didn't seem concerned about it at all. It's kind of interfering with some of my everyday activities. And I'm wondering, is this something that I can go to, or I should go to a neurologist for, or
yes.
should I just learn to live with it?
If it's interfering with your activities, you know, like writing, eating, keyboarding, I would recommend that some primary care doctors are comfortable starting some treatment, but if you're in a situation where you feel that's not the case, certainly seeing a neurologist would be very reasonable.
And intentional tremor, what would you talk about what that is?
Yeah, that's usually a different terminology, but it's something called essential tremor. So it's shaking of the hands when you're using your hands, which is different than from a Parkinson's tremor, for example, where the shaking may occur when the limb is at rest. So in essential tremor, the tremors can be very mild and people accommodate to them, but then they can, in some people they will progress and become increasingly actually disabling because it limits the use of the hands, you know, like spilling when you're eating or that sort of thing. Can't do fine motor types of things.
Katie, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. John in Janesville, your turn. Hi, John.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Larry. I just wanted you to touch on I've got a brother and sister that have Parkinson's, a cousin that had it, an uncle. So there must be the genetic connection here, I would assume, because that's a pretty small population that would have that many people. And then is there something that maybe at some point, maybe we would have an indicator that this might be something that as you get older, you may be at risk for?
Right. So the fact that it's in your family puts you already at risk, just like if, you know, you had family members with heart disease or certain forms of cancer. So you have a definite risk factor for Parkinson's disease. There have been some genes associated with it. And the question always comes up, well, should I undergo some genetic testing? And that's very that's person dependent. There's various views. For example, some of the genes, it's not definitive that you would develop signs of Parkinson's. However, they've been associated with it. And would you want that information or not? That's what you always need to think of for any type of genetic testing. What would that information do for you or family members? And I always recommend some genetic counseling. Currently, we don't screen the population for any of these genes because we don't have a treatment. And so, you know, depending on how someone wants to use that information, it may be helpful. Sometimes it may be detrimental. What I usually tell people in my practice when, you know, there are more than one family member with Parkinson's, which is very common, actually, that really taking good care of yourself, you know, meaning, you know, try to get some regular exercise, get good sleep, you know, watch what you eat, all those lifestyle things can actually make a difference. The only potential neuroprotective treatment we have now, meaning slowing down disease progression, is actually exercise. And there's lots of ways exercise can benefit us, but there seems to be something about the exercise that is helpful specifically in Parkinson's disease. So
probably helpful in a lot of ways.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
John, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And by exercise, it could be a variety. I mean, just getting out and walking.
Right. And there are some, you know, for people who are diagnosed, there's lots of very wonderful exercise programs specific to or for people living with Parkinson's disease. And those can be very beneficial. It's also a support network, too, which is also beneficial. There'll be different fads in the type of exercise. For a while, it was bicycling and still, bicycling is good. Currently, there's rock steady boxing has been very popular and helpful for people where they do a little boxing, but also a whole bunch of other exercises and things in the program. So there isn't, you know, really one particular exercise. You have to look at the individual and see how the Parkinson's is affecting them and see, first of all, what they could do safely, but also what types of exercise would be helpful. And that's where our physical therapists are really awesome at helping guide people.
We have Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum on the show once a month. So maybe we'll take that up as a topic for one of the programs. I think that would be
wonderful.
I think it'd be really good. Carol in Fitchburg, we'll talk to you. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Larry. Hello, and thank you to your guests.
Absolutely. What's on your mind?
I really appreciate this program, though what I wanted to ask about was anything having to do with research on post-stroke neurological issues. I can give you the situation in that we've been dealing with. 14 years ago, my husband had a stroke, a rare stroke called a Wallenberg, which he recovered from maybe 90%, 95%. And we thought we were free and clear. And then 3 years ago, he started to have neurological symptoms, rather extreme ones, which finally this year were diagnosed as a susceptibility to neurological problems of what looked like sudden onset dementia and inability to walk. Is this sounding like anything you've heard before?
Yes.
She's nodding yes as you were talking,
yes,
Carol.
Yeah. And I'm sorry that you and your husband are dealing with this. There is a lot of research going on in stroke rehab. Oftentimes that comes under the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehab, looking at these long-term effects of stroke. But that is, unfortunately, people who have had one stroke could be prone to others or just different neurologic conditions that can be very devastating. Across the country, across the world, there's a lot of research going on into those kinds of things.
And where would you go for information on that? I mean, what would be for Carol or anybody else?
I would look to the, actually, sometimes the American Heart Association has stroke-related and post-stroke things.
Yeah, hadn't thought of
you
that.
You know, different, you know, the American Academy of Neurology has some excellent patient or people living with a condition oriented materials that are very supportive too. There's a publication called the Brain Life magazine that is available to people through the American Academy of Neurology.
Carol, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too. The number to call, I'll get you on pretty quickly, open lines. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. And we've got some emails here we should probably get through, too. Summer emailed us. She has an older sister who has been diagnosed with spinal ataxia 6. Is it related to Parkinson's?
It is not. The mechanism of the spinocerebellar ataxia, sometimes called SCAs or SCAs, has a different biologic mechanism, although a lot of times the different movement disorders clinically or what you see in the people experience that are living with them can have some similarities.
Virginia emailed us. Virginia's father just passed away with Lewy body dementia and Parkinson's. Oh, she's wondering what's the likelihood she or her brother, this was her father, so would she or her brother be possibly have develop it?
Yeah, that's very hard to know, as we don't have any there's genetic information being collected, but so far a gene hasn't been identified, as far as I know, for dementia with Lewy bodies or Lewy body dementia. Because he had one of these neurodegenerative conditions, there is a slightly increased risk of you have a risk factor now, just as if you had heart disease or something like that. It acts like a risk factor. So there's not like a 50-50 chance or something like that. They are at some increased risk.
Mark wondered about essential tremor and treatments, options for essential tremor.
Right. Essential tremor is that other tremor that occurs when people are using their hands, and there's medications available. There's some assistive devices. Often this affects people's ability to eat, so there's some specialized eating utensils that can be used. And when it's super severe, people can undergo deep brain stimulation surgery, which can be fairly effective.
Jean in Merrill has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jean.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. As you speak of research yet to be done, now that we're making leaps and bounds in neurology, I have a particular movement disorder that doesn't, I think, have a comprehensive name for what's going on, in that diagnosed with herpes in my 30s, and then herpes became a huge collection of many different subdivisions of herpes, which then gets thrown into shingles now that I'm 70. What is the connection, neurologically speaking, from that brain-based signal to my actual limbs? In that whenever I'm undergoing a shingles herpes attack, I feel it shooting neurologically through my lower pelvis down through my legs, and it makes every difference in the world as to whether I can get up, get down, do my horseback riding at the age of 70. I'm very aware of all that. And then I remember my grandparents speaking of this catch-all phrase called sciatica.
Yep. So sciatica is a very specific disorder caused by a pinching of the nerve, so to speak, a specific nerve that comes from the low back down into the legs. The connection that a lot of people will have things that we don't have a definitive explanation for, but the virus that causes shingles and all that stuff does remain in the nerves. And so some people, that's why they'll get an attack of shingles, is because the nerve and the virus gets reactivated. And you'll hear more about that with the next guest, the shingles expert, yeah, that will be talking about that. But because it affects the nerves and nervous system, people can have tons of different symptoms that will affect them.
Laura was wondering, has an autoimmune disease, Behçet's disease, a fairly rare disease, mm-hmm, in this country, but wondering if that could be a precursor to a movement disorder like...
Yeah, not usually.
Diane in Portage, your turn. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I would like to ask, and I'm sorry, I missed the very first part of your program, and I hear that you were discussing REM disorders and Parkinson's. I have a friend who's experiencing Parkinson's, and she's having terrible problems with nightmares and trying to get sustained sleep and true rest and things. Is this more a matter of medication side effects, or is it the Parkinson's?
Oh, it could be either or both. People that live with Parkinson's will develop sleep disorders to varying degrees. They can have sleep fragmentation, so they can fall asleep, but they can only stay asleep for a few hours. Some people, if they reach that deep level of sleep, our REM sleep, they'll have dream enactment. So mechanisms that usually paralyze us during our sleep are not functioning properly in people with Parkinson's, and so they're able to act out those dreams. And sometimes for some people, the medicines will worsen that if she's on things like carbidopa, levodopa, or various dopamine agonists. And like everything in Parkinson's and even neurology, it's quite variable, and people will respond differently. But that is certainly something that she can speak to her physicians about to help manage. Obviously, she'll feel a whole lot better. She can sleep a little bit better.
Yeah, for sure. I was thinking back as you were talking. It's been years and years since I had one of those episodes where you wake up and you can't move. It's a scary thing.
It is, yeah. Yeah.
it is indeed. Diane, thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, and we have open lines to get you on pretty quickly here, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today. Tomorrow on the show, we have some of our favorite outdoor writers back, and the three of them will be talking about current issues in nature and wildlife, and you'll be able to join in with your questions. Right now, we're talking with Dr. Laura Bouillon-Dent, who is a neurologist, director of the Movement Disorders and Parkinson's Program at UW Health. Questions, comments, experience to share, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. And let's go to Bob in Monroe next. Bob, thank you for calling.
Yes, hello. So my question is, what is the expected course, or if there is a treatment for benign paroxysmal positional vertigo?
That's really variable. That's part of the a special part of the brain called the vestibular system, part of the brain that helps with the ears too. And people will have it to varying degrees. The most useful thing that I've found when people are experiencing that is to see a specialized physical therapist that can do some vestibular rehab with people, and they can teach people that live with this some techniques, because it's the sort of thing that will tend to flare, and then it gets a little bit better and then flares. You know, it's a up and down type of thing.
So you'd probably want somebody with that specific kind of training.
Right, right.
Be calling around a little bit, perhaps. I'm sure there are some at UW.
Right, correct. Usually it's a physical therapist that will specialize in neurorehabilitation versus like orthopedic rehabilitation. And they will have specialized training and can do vestibular rehabilitation.
There you go, Bob. Thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Jonah in Eau Claire next. Jonah, hi. Thank you for calling.
Howdy.
What can we do for you?
Yeah, I'm calling to inquire about like the precursor conditions for Parkinson's, if there are any, or any like very early onset symptoms. As someone in my youth with family with a lot of neurodegenerative disorders, like how early can you tell, and through what avenues?
Right. That's a real tough one. Usually, some people will have something called REM behavior disorder, a dream reenactment. Some people will have a variety of symptoms. However, at the time, they might not be aware, but once the disease progresses, they will look back and say, oh, I wonder, you know, if in retrospect, oh, my bad constipation was maybe the very first sign. So, you know, it's hard because you feel like you're living in this state where you're monitoring, right, to see, oh, my gosh, am I going to get that? And that's not a fun place to live, but I usually suggest to people and family members that they just try to stay active, they be aware. If they are worried, you know, they can request to see a neurologist or a movement disorder specialist if that's helpful. Currently, there isn't any medication or anything to take, you know, to slow or, you know, prevent the onset. Those things are in development. Sometimes participating in a clinical trial is helpful for people. The Michael J. Fox Foundation has a trial where they're collecting lots of different data for a big worldwide database, and that can be accessed online through the Michael J. Fox Foundation. It's the PPMI, Progressive Parkinson's Marker Initiative, I believe is what the initials stand for. So doing things like that sometimes help people when they're in this state of worry and anxiety about if they're going to develop something or not.
You know, I'm going to go back to exercise for a minute. I was thinking about, I get up every morning early and do a few miles in the morning before, and nothing all that strenuous, but I think you feel better.
Right. Right.
After you're, or while you're doing it, and yeah, and after.
Yeah. And so there's lots of good reasons to exercise. And if you're worried about a neurodegenerative disease, that's good. There's in the Parkinson's field, there actually has been basic science studies using different animal models that have force the animals to exercise. And when they look at the brain, it does seem to even have some sort of brain response. So it's not just, you know, developing stamina so your body can be more resilient to handle the effects of the disease, but there might be release of neurotrophic factors that help the brain cells survive and stay healthy. So there is some evidence even for that, that I tell myself when I'm trying to get moving.
Jonah, get moving. There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Lori in Rockton, Illinois. We'll go to you now. Hi, Lori.
Well, hello, everyone. I am calling just kind of as a point of interest for your listeners. I have a very, very good friend who is at the tail end of PSP, progressive supranuclear palsy, which is a really, really horrible disease. It's rare, but yet it seems like it's on the rise. And I don't know if that's because my ears are attuned to it now. Very difficult to diagnose. It's kind of a process of elimination. But it is out there, and many, many people have no idea how to treat it, whether they're caregivers or speech pathologists, OT, PT. It's a very, very difficult, horrible disease.
Progressive supranuclear palsy.
Right. Progressive supranuclear palsy. That is something that a movement disorder specialist is good at diagnosing. I mean, good in, you know, parentheses, at diagnosing. It is considered one of the atypical forms of Parkinson's. And it's one of the things that a good movement disorders neurologist will be screening for all the time. You know, when they've diagnosed Parkinson's, they usually will be looking for signs of that. And you're right that it's a horrible disease. Not that any of these things are good diseases. People will feel isolated, and oftentimes I've had my patients that I've diagnosed with this condition benefit actually from some of the Parkinson's Foundation and the Parkinson's patient sites will give at least some support. We throw them under that umbrella. Because especially at end stages, things can be somewhat similar. But yes, your friend was lucky that you were there to support her, or is lucky, Lori, that your support is there.
Yes, and thank you very much for calling. Kelly in Mill Bluff, thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because I've recently had some testing done. I had a scan as well as MRI, which both were showed to be normal, but I have a mixed tremor, resting postural and action tremor, and have had muscle weakness, especially difficulty with walking.
Okay.
And we've trialed carbidopa levodopa for a bit, and that helped me so much. Like, I can get moving again.
Okay.
With that medication, but like the DAS scan looked normal.
Right.
So are there any other conditions for which carbidopa levodopa would be effective?
There can be, but the thing to know about the DAT scan is that there's a lot of false negatives that can occur with it. So depending on how that's used, just, you know, any test has a certain degree of false positives and false negatives. None of them have 100% specificity and sensitivity, as we say. And so I have many patients who have mixed tremors and this sort of thing, and are developing Parkinson's, and their DAT scan might be negative. So DAT scans can miss Parkinson's disease, unfortunately. I can't say that you have that, you know, because I haven't been able to meet you and examine you, but you might want to see someone who is specialized in movement disorders. They'd be able to handle that quite well and give you appropriate medications and not get you over-medicated, all that good stuff.
Someone else is wondering in an email if anyone has done research on hypnosis to treat central tremors.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if there's any formal studies of that. I've certainly had my patients with essential tremor talk about that. And I know that there's been people who are good at meditation that will find that that helps reduce their tremors, especially in anxiety-provoking things. But I don't know if there's been any. I imagine there's been some formal hypnosis studies, but I'm not familiar with those. I think anything that helps people calm down to some degree will help with their tremors, no matter what the cause, because if we're even normal anxiety of going to work or social, you know, fun anxiety, our adrenaline is going, and that will often make the tremors a little bit worse than usual, even if you're not anxious per se. But any of those conditions, just like after exercise, people who live with tremors are usually quite shaky as well. So.
And on that note, Dr. Laura, thank you so much for being with us. You'll come back and be with us again, I hope.
Oh, I hope so. If you'll have me back, I'll be here.
Oh, we
will. Thank you for this opportunity.
Dr. Laura Bouillon-Dent, neurologist and director of the Movement Disorders and Parkinson's Program at UW Health. It was great to have her with us. And thank you so much for listening. And coming up next, we're going to be talking about shingles and shingles treatments. I'm Larry Mueller.